Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
On this episode of The Booze Hustle, I talk to legendary Karen McNeil, American author, journalist, and wine educator. So if you're anything like me, one of the first books I ever owned about wine was Karen's book, The Wine Bible, a book that famously took almost 8 years for her to complete. Almost every wine professional I know owns a copy, making Karen's book one of the most influential pieces of wine education of our time. As far as wine journalism goes, Karen's career is an aspirational reflection of years of incredible feats. She was one of the first wine and food editors of USA Today in the early 80s. She hosted a PBS series called Wine, Food, and Friends, for which she won an Emmy. She's won the James Beard Award for Wine and Spirits Professional and been nominated 2 other times, and is the creator and chairman emerita at the Rudd Center for Professional Wine Studies at the Culinary Institute of America in St. Helena, California. Most recently, she's launched an online newsletter called Wine Speed that offers subscribers a fast, informative snapshot of her recommendations, news, quizzes, things like that. And all of that on its own is remarkable, right? But what I most resonated with about Karen, which I didn't anticipate to, was how she's built this career on tenacity, hard work, how much she's really shaped the wine world and restaurant service. I discovered we have similar origin stories, and she was really gracious and opened up about things that she typically doesn't talk too much about. One of my favorite things on this podcast is really the common thread when I talk to people about their backgrounds, and one thing always kind of remains a constant. People who are really successful have these incredibly amazing backstories. You know, they went up against adversity, or they started, you know, with really modest beginnings and humble beginnings and had to kind of, you know, hustle their way through life. And that is completely true with Karen as well. And I had such a great conversation with her. She continues to inspire me. She's a icon in journalism and in the wine world. And I really hope you enjoy the episode as much as I enjoyed talking to her. Cheers. Where in St. Helena are you guys? I'm actually going to be out there next weekend.
We are right on Main Street, just a few doors south of Model Bakery, which is,
oh, okay,
for many people, they would know Model Bakery. We're in the big green building in the center of town, which is actually the oldest building in St. Helena. Was built in the 1880s.
Okay.
So it's very nice. It's got a lot of good old bones. And it's been standing here in the Napa Valley more than 100 years now.
Mm-hmm. And it's where you record a lot of your interviews. I see your background and where you do your a lot of your wine speed videos, which is great.
Yes. Where are you coming from? Where are you?
So I live in Connecticut.
Oh, nice.
I work for a wine and spirits supplier. I cover the Northeast for our fine wine craft spirits portfolio. I do kind of education, sales, distributor wrangling. And then I do this to kind of maintain a bit of sanity. I went to school for journalism and thought I was going to make a career in journalism, and was quickly bummed out when I graduated and realized that I couldn't have a career in journalism because I didn't have any money. And the jobs that I was being offered in Chicago, I wouldn't have been able to make a living wage. And I was working in restaurants, and I was making a lot of money in a restaurant. And I was like, well, maybe this is, maybe I'm going to rethink this a little bit. So I've always just kept writing, and this is a passion, and then leaned into the restaurant and then wine and spirits as a career builder. So, you know, I also like the excitement of the restaurant world. I feel like being at home with my own thoughts too much is not a good thing. So it's fun to be around restaurant people and still be able to, even now, like connected to that world a great deal. So I get the best parts.
When I started out, I worked in restaurants for a while. And I agree with you, the adrenaline every day is so good. Mm-hmm. And I also agree with you that it's really incredibly hard to make your living as a journalist. There are, you know, the number, when I began, the number of newspapers that had wine columnists was probably in the 30s. Now there are mm-hmm. essentially two, right? There's the New York Times and the San Francisco Chronicle, and those are the only two papers that have mm-hmm. a full-time paid on staff wine writer. It's amazing.
Yep. I know. And it's everything gets fielded out now. And I remember my senior year, I did this, I forget, it was like some sort of consortium with writers from across the country. And Arthur Sulzberger Jr. was there. And I had such high hopes about this career in journalism. And then I realized really quickly, I was like, I was there for magazine journalism. I was like, all of the magazines are closing. Like, this is not good. No. And then I have several friends who are still writers, and they have, you know, they hustle and they make a living. But it's a hard life. And, you know, I grew up with no money, and I decided a long time ago that I was not going to spend my life that way. So yeah. I was a hustler. I decided, like, let's figure out a way to, you know, do both things.
And good for you. You have. And you are.
I'm trying. Do it. We're all just doing our best, Karen.
That's exactly right.
I did want to say, you know, leading up to this interview today, obviously, I have a lot of colleagues that know who you are, and you are just so well known and revered in the wine industry, especially among women. So I was kind of, you know, outsourcing. I'm like, what do you want to ask Karen? And it was so funny. I had some pretty great feedback from some people. But, you know, that really is just a testament to your impact to the wine business, you know, over the course of your career. So I was doing a lot of as much research as I could do on your background. And I was really surprised to learn how young you were when you started out as a writer. So I was interested just because, you know, everything I've read about you, like starting out, I read you were 19 when you went to New York. And you started as a writer. So I'm curious, like, where are you from? Where were you born? Where did you grow up? And where did you go to school?
Those are questions I rarely answer. But I will answer, of course. I grew up in, I was born in Boston and spent maybe 10 years there, and then grew up way out in the Nevada desert outside of Reno. My family also was very poor. And so I left home at a very young age and made my way eventually to New York City with I arrived on Thanksgiving Day with $6 left and knew nobody. So it was a bit of a trial by fire. Mm-hmm. But I did hope in New York that I could become a writer. And you can tell how young I was, because that is a dream of naivete, in a sense. It takes a lot. And in my case, I worked during the day, two jobs, and apprenticed myself at night and was writing on the side. But even so, I collected 324 rejection slips before my first article was published.
Wow. This, you know, there's a bit of naivete, but I think there's also this really great thing that happens when you don't have a safety net. You get this, I have to do it. So you pull this bravery from this deep well of yourself. And when you don't have that many responsibilities or people to take care of, it's a lot easier, I think, to like just dive in, and you're just going to do it until something works. I was reading that one of the first articles you had published was in the Village Voice, and it was about cheese. Is that correct? Artisanal cheese?
Close. Butter.
Okay. What was it? Oh, butter. Butter.
Yes.
So did you have an interest in food and wine from an early age, or was this one of those you know, I'm going to research and I'm going to become an expert and then dive in that way?
You know, there were two real reasons, Kristen. One was that writing about food, when I first started out, I was writing about everything, politics, social issues, women's issues. And I was poor enough to be on food stamps in New York. And one day I had what I thought was this brilliant idea. Maybe I should start writing about food because maybe they gave you samples. And that would be a way to improve my food stamp diet, which it turned out was true. But I also, quite more seriously, I did always love food and eventually wine too, because as you would know, we sort of share similar backgrounds. When you don't have a lot of money, food is one of your only pleasures. And I loved, and it could be the simplest, meatloaf, whatever, right? Mm-hmm. A taco. I loved the fact also that food was a door into culture, that it was a door into friendship, it was a door into getting to know people, but it also revealed all kinds of aspects of culture. And of course, later I realized that wine does the same thing. So I to this day, I love being a journalist about now principally wine, but sometimes food too, because of that, because they reveal culture.
I wonder if it wasn't the avenue of wine that you went down, what was the other special interest? Because everyone I know that's a career professional in one way or the other, they have, you know, the thing that they're most known for, and then they have the thing that everyone else knows that they do, but nobody else knows. So what is that thing that you are also very passionate about that isn't wine?
Boy, is there anything besides wine and food? I don't know. I mean,
good question.
You know,
fair.
I guess, you know, sometimes people ask that question in a different way. What would you do if you didn't need to write about wine and food? Or what do you do when you're not writing about wine and food? And I'm like, eat and drink. My life is, yeah, my professional life is also my personal life. But I suppose the one other area that is very related to these two things is I'm fascinated by the kind of anthropology of dining and service, and where did manners come from, and why do we put the fork on the left, and all of those kinds of aspects of, mm-hmm, of dining behavior. In the 1980s, I started a school in New York called the New York Professional Service School that actually taught servers professional dining room service. So it's related, but I love that too.
Yeah, I think that I was always attracted to fine dining in my restaurant career because it was the antithesis of what I knew. And it seemed so aspirational and so nice. Like, oh, people don't eat on their couch while watching TV all the time. Like, there's like a specific fork you should be using. And I often felt like a caveman when I first started eating in nice restaurants. I was like, okay, this is fancy. And I think I actually kind of maybe pushed against it a little bit, it being young and being like, ugh, what is, you know, this is too fancy. But as I've gotten older, I've very much started to appreciate the ritualistic or tradition behind things, because I think it really does create some comfort or sense memory from really great experiences that you've had. So I find that really interesting as well. How long did you run that school for?
About almost 10 years. And
wow,
the interesting aspect of that is in the beginning, I thought, oh, think of all the restaurants with terrible service. This is going to be great. This is the school will be packed. And in point of fact, no restaurant with bad service ever sent us a single waiter. The restaurants who did were the restaurants like Union Square Cafe, all of Danny Meyer's restaurants, mm-hmm, the Four Seasons in New York, restaurants that already were quite extraordinary in terms of their service, you know, wanted to get even better. And I suppose that's a parallel for anything that we do. It's often when you are already pretty good at something that you have this internal drive to be, mm-hmm, even better at what you do.
That's so true. I talk to people all the time that want to be consultants. And I say, you know, often the places that need the most work are not going to pay you. And it's a part of it is they can't afford to pay you because their business probably isn't doing well because, you know, it's like the chicken or the egg, like full circle thing. But that's really interesting. So from there, you kind of segued this career into being a wine editor, obviously famously the Wine Bible. And really, I have a lot of questions about the Wine Bible, and I'm sure you get these all the time. But I wonder, you know, reflecting back on all these really incredible accomplishments, is there one thing that, like, you look back today and think, like, this is the thing that I'm most proud of, the feather in your cap? What would that be?
I suppose it would be, you know, when I was starting out and thinking about and seeing if I could become a published writer, there were no real good external signs that this was going to be possible. I'd never taken a writing class. I didn't go to journalism school. But in my mind, I loved the idea of trying to communicate ideas. And so early on, I thought, you know, I'm going to try every type of writing. Writing books, writing for magazines, writing for newspapers, radio, television, advertising writing. And in fact, the last stone kind of in that circle has been our most recent endeavor, digital writing, which is our newsletter, Wine Speed. But I think when you do that, when you try and master, or at least jump in the pool of different types of communication, at some point they wind up helping one another. So, you know, it was very helpful to have done radio, for example, a live radio call-in show in New York, when I was writing, when I later wrote the Wine Bible, because in radio, there was this idea that every 11 minutes, a listener's attention changes radically. And so every 11 minutes, you have to change. You have to speed up or slow down or infuse the conversation with a different kind of emotion or something. And, you know, the Wine Bible, when it first came out, the first edition came out in 2001. It was a radically different kind of wine writing. Nobody was writing about wine in that way. And in the way of all these nuggets and side boxes and things you could quickly, quickly learn about and in a fascinating way learn about. So I think I'm proud that I've used different types of communication to inform other types. It's like a big star in my mind, and it all comes together in the center.
It's all connected, yeah. And everything informed writing that, I'm sure. Let's talk.
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com and get up to 15% off your first purchase as a member with code REBAGNEW. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAGNEW for up to 15% off your first purchase as a member.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
About the Wine Bible for a moment, because what an undertaking, first of all. I think most people would be hesitant to even try. And famously, it did take quite a long time to work on that. How did you approach that process? And did you have a team of people working with you? Or was this like a complete just put my head down work for many, many years?
Yes, I have a team now, but I didn't then. And wow. The first Wine Bible took 8 years to write, and then 2 years before it was fully published. 8 unpaid years. Whoa. Almost no one works on a project for 8 years unpaid. But and the most amazing thing about the Wine Bible, I came to understand this years later, why it had very little competition, was because when I started the research for the Wine Bible, the internet was not what it is today. Mm-hmm. In fact, even wineries that had websites, websites were not considered by publishers legitimate fact-checking entities. Mm-hmm. And yeah. So I had 40 feet of transfile boxes of notes, of phone calls and faxes from every wow. place in the world. You can imagine, without an internet, just how hard it would be to even find the right person who mm. knew what you were after. I mean, I remember trying to figure out something for the Hungarian chapter, and I thought, oh my God, where do you start?
Truly.
But I've always written every word of every Wine Bible. This last wow. third edition that came out last year, I did have a number of WSET students who helped me as researchers. Mm-hmm. But even so, I would say I'm the toughest researcher of all.
I would agree. I would agree. And especially because it's a living, breathing document. This is not a book that gets published and then you're done. It's as the wine industry evolves and grows and changes, and wineries changes and regions change, and winemakers are doing crazier and wilder things. I mean, this is something that could go on forever. And with that in mind, like, what is the legacy of the Wine Bible? Like, when you know, you're not going to be able to write it in 100 years from now. So are
oh,
you
yes,
going to create
am.
Some? Well, you give me your secrets, Karen.
Yes. I think a book like that will continue in much the way that Hugh Johnson's World Atlas of Wine it was it's on my bookshelf too, and Hugh Johnson is such a wonderful man and a good friend of mine, but he kept doing it for years, and then he decided to co-author it with Jancis Robinson, another friend, and so maybe at some point there will be a co-author on the Wine Bible. But it's the way of talking about wine that I think is so different. Almost everyone who even picks it up for a second and thumbs through it will say to me, gosh, it feels like you're just talking to me. And that always makes me feel very happy and proud, because the Wine Bible is not didactic. It's not me kind of telling you how it is. It's not me journalism. It's a kind of we're in this together tone of journalism, which which I think for wine, the Wine Bible was the first.
And I very much appreciate that. I think one of the things that I most enjoy about the book is that tone specifically. And I also, in watching a lot of interviews with you and, you know, some of your videos on Wine Speed, I very much enjoy the way that you talk about wine in a non-pretentious way, because I think that's where I think we start to lose some of the younger generations. And when it's, you know, gatekept idea, or, you know, you have to have a lot of education to understand it, you know, you really start to kind of exclude people that might really enjoy learning about it. And I think my first wine job, and I've talked about this on the podcast before, but my first wine job in Chicago is at a wine bar called Volo. And the wine director there, his name was Shad with an S, and he was very cool. He was a hippie, he played the guitar, and, you know, he was just, he made it so easy for me to understand. He would talk to me like, oh, you want to learn about a grape called Zweigelt? And I was like, yes, I do. And he actually is the one that told me to buy the Wine Bible. Well, actually, that's not true. First, he told me to read Wine for Dummies because I really didn't get it. And then as I learned more, then we graduated to the Wine Bible and so on. But I think that's so important. And I wonder what your thoughts are about how we're going to reach, or how we're going to continue to outreach to the younger generation of consumers, essentially, who seem to be dropping off in the wine area.
Yeah, you know, I started worrying about this myself about, I would say, 6 years ago. I thought to myself, okay, the Wine Bible, it's good. I'm proud of it. But it's a big book. It, you know, weighs 2 pounds. And 6 or 7 years ago, all of a sudden, there was this entity called a blog. And I remember thinking, I don't know. I mean, I'd spent my whole life trying to be paid for articles. Now I was now like, here are all these people writing for free. What does this mean? But as I watched blogs proliferate, with the exception of just a couple, like Alder Yarrow, who is so good, but with the exception of just a few people, a lot of blogs were kind of fast and furious, but they were very minimal in terms of fact checking. There was no editor, right? Nobody said, how do you know that in fact Pinot Noir is the second leading grape in New Zealand or whatever? And so I thought, okay, if I can do the Wine Bible, I'm going to turn the binoculars completely around and create something that is fast and fascinating and hopefully will appeal to a whole different demographic. But it will have some level of authoritativeness behind it. Mm-hmm. So, and that became our digital newsletter, Wine Speed, which I'm sure there are people who have never even seen the Wine Bible who are subscribers to Wine Speed, because it is exactly that. It's fast, it's fun, it's furious. We have, you know, you can read the whole thing in less time than it takes to open a bottle of wine. Mm-hmm. And people love it. It's their like weekly dose of wine mm-hmm. education comes to you, to your email box. And so I think, you know, wine communication has to change. And I like to think that with Wine Speed, we're on that helpful gerbil wheel of helping wine communications change and be more modern and more fun, more fast.
Yeah, because there's a lot of content out there. It's just, how are we serving it to people and how are they consuming it? And I think that's the age old question now is, you know, how to capture everyone's, you know, 2 minutes of attention. And I do very much enjoy Wine Speed. Thank you. You know, you guys introduced me to Wine Speed, and I have spent quite a bit of time on there, and I enjoy the quizzes, and there's great videos as well. And I was actually, which interview I was watching earlier, Oz, what's his name?
Oz Clark.
Oh yeah, I enjoyed that interview that you did with him. So I think that you are accomplishing that in taking, you know, something as dense as, or even encyclopedia-like, and finding a way to give it to people in smaller doses that are a little bit more exciting in the moment. I do still worry about the amount of consumption that's happening, though, not just in the information space, but in the wine space. In your world, I'm sure you talk to a ton of wine professionals. What do you think that is specifically that's different today about wine drinkers than maybe wine drinkers 20 years ago?
Yes, you know, there are sort of two viewpoints here. One is that, you know, the sky is falling in. Millennials are not drinking wine, and Gen Z people are not either. And the other viewpoint is, well, give them time, right? People come around, people change their drinking habits and patterns. I'm a bit in the latter school. I think I don't view beer or cocktails as worrisome. I do view this one thing as worrisome, though, and that is that very few voices out there are talking about why wine matters. It's emotional connection to nature, its ability to bring people together, the whole communal history of wine. It's not just alcohol, right? Because there are a lot of ways you could just get alcohol. But I find that the story of wine and why it touches us, that story isn't being told enough. Mm. And that's going to be a problem, because almost everyone who falls in love with wine falls head over heels, and they never unfall out of love. They never say, oh, you know what, I drank wine there for a few years, but now I'm past it. Now I'm moving on to something else. Once you fall in love with wine, you usually really find its mystery, its fascinations, its magic, its transformative ability. All those things start to really get to you in a good way. And I think the wine industry needs to tell that story more.
That's true. And to be fair, and I think I am also in the latter camp, I don't think I drank that much wine when I was very young anyway. I think it started when you were a little bit more into drinking wine for enjoyment, not just because you're in a, you know, party mode or something. But I very much appreciate that. And I actually interviewed for this season a gentleman, he's a professor, who wrote a book called Finding Meaning in Wine. I don't know if you've seen that floating around in the ether yet, but he spent a lot of time with winemakers interviewing some really fantastic, you know, personalities out in California, and really kind of doing a lot of literary comparisons to wine versus art. And I you know, I'm excited for that episode, because I think it's really helpful in creating that conversation around meaning of wine and its place in our society. So thank you for mentioning that. I also wonder, you taste a lot of wine, obviously. How many wines would you say a year that you're tasting?
We usually taste here in my office three times a week at a minimum, and I would say we taste probably 2,000 to 2,500 wines a year.
My gosh.
And that kind of keeps you knowledgeable globally.
Sure.
And of course, it's funny that a lot of my British colleagues think of, when they think of me, they think of, oh, Napa Valley in California. But we just finished tasting 125 Chianti Classicos this week.
Wow.
So we have to stay, both because of wine speed, but also because of the Wine Bible, we have to stay global. And mm-hmm. So it's lucky. Some woman has to do it.
Yeah, it's true. I know this is going to be a very trivial question, but this is actually something one of my colleagues wanted me to ask you. But you must have the hangover cure by now. Like, what is it? Because if anyone has it, it's you.
Yeah, boy. I mean, it is a concern, right? Because you have to spit well. You have to drink a lot of water. You have to make sure you're hydrated. There was a time when I could taste, I don't know, you know, 50 Cabernets. And I never do that anymore. You know, I'd rather taste every day and taste 12 wines than one day taste 50 wines.
You can't feel your tongue for 3 days.
Yeah, exactly. I also think that exercise really helps. I work out every single morning. And even if I wake up and I think, oh, that was one too many Chianti Classicos last night, I get on that exercise bike no matter what. Speed up the metabolism, drink bunches of water, and keep going.
That's good advice. I need to do that more. I really do want to know, like, what – listen, it's like picking your favorite child is picking your favorite wine when you work in the wine business, but is there something that you go to more often that is like your comfort wine that you drink?
I would say, well, I do drink a glass of champagne every night, and and I have for 20 years. Champagne is so, it's so fabulous. It's such an expressive wine, and the fact that it is, relatively speaking, low in alcohol is also kind of, is very nice. But I love, champagne has such energy. I think it's all those limestone and marl soils, maybe, but I love its briskness. I love it when champagne is really starched and minerally. And best of all, I suppose, I like the idea of demarcating the day from the night. I work a lot, but of course, everybody can work with a glass of champagne on their desk. Oh, that's my view. That's actually the view of my employees, too. If we're here at 6 o'clock and everybody's still working, they're like, how about we open a bottle of champagne? Okay.
I mean, we should.
We should. And we do. So there's that. And I the last few years, I have just so fallen in love with Pinot Noir from the far west Sonoma coast. And also from the Willamette Valley. I'm ready to open a Pinot Noir from either of those places at the drop of a hat. Yeah. So I would say those two are my kind of comfort wines.
Sure. And that kind of goes back to, you know, this idea of ritual and tradition and formality is having that glass of champagne every day and separating the day from the night. So that tracks that you do that. Those wines being things that stand out for you, or is there a particular, and we don't have to talk about any wineries or anyone like that, but is there a particular wine that you think is very overrated that people just kind of go bananas for and you don't quite understand why?
Wow. You know, I think that one of the principles of wine is to learn the idea that when you don't like a wine, maybe you haven't tasted enough of it yet. When I'm being serious, when I don't like a wine, I think, okay, well, wait a minute. A, what's wrong? Is there something wrong with this wine? Okay. B, am I paying enough attention? And C, have I drunk enough of this yet? And I learned that lesson as a young woman, the very first time I went to Jerez, and I thought, I'm not sure I could drink sherry like, you know, 5 times a day for 7 straight days. But what I realized is that some wines are rites of passage. And foods are like that too. Almost no one fell in love with sushi the first time they tasted it. It was the repeated tasting of it. And then one day, you know, the light switch flipped and you sort of got it, like, oh, I get sushi now. And then you fell completely in love with it. So I think wines are like that too. Certain wines I've needed to taste over and over again until the light switch flips.
Yeah, that's great advice. I remember very early in my wine journey, every time I tasted specific Italian wines, I was like, is this bottle corked? I didn't understand quite yet. And then over time, Italian wines are now my favorite. On like a Tuesday night, I'll open a bottle of Italian wine every time. Well, that's actually very good advice, especially for people who are just learning about wine. And my favorite thing to say to people is don't yuck someone's yum. You like what you like. And if you enjoy it, that's all that matters. And if it's wine, bonus points, buy what you like and enjoy it. So, well, I'd like to just circle back for a minute to Wine Speed. I'd really like to talk a little bit about what your goals are for Wine Speed, what the future looks like for it. And for our listeners, it is a subscription-based e-newsletter that comes to your email, but you could also visit it on their website, winespeed.com. But would you mind just telling us a little bit more about like the future for it and what people could expect from it?
Sure. You know, when I think when people think about reading about wine, there's a hesitancy. They think, oh, this is going to be, you know, this is going to be like going back to school. This is going to be very pedantic and heavy and, you know, gray column after gray column. And I wanted to change that dynamic because for me, the world of wine is endlessly fascinating. And one of the biggest things people ask me is, how do you find all this stuff? Like, if anybody knows the ratio of sheep to winemakers in New Zealand, it's me, right? I have found that fact. And and stuff like that is fun to know. It's what keeps wine lively and to some extent humorous. And you know, one of the first things that we created with Wine Speed is the wine quiz. And I mean, the wine quiz, there are so many people who love wine who they will email me afterwards saying, damn it, I got the wine quiz wrong. I know whole teams, whole sales teams who like compete every week for how many people get the wine quiz right. And, you know, I guess our goal is to keep doing that, because a little bit like the Wine Bible, I think with Wine Speed, I stumbled on something that people could relate to and that had resonance. And I've always figured if it's fascinating to me, maybe it'll be fascinating to all kinds of other people. And that was true for the Wine Bible, and it's certainly true for Wine Speed. And I like bringing to people every week something that is almost, in a sense, right in front of them, but they've never thought about it before. Like, mm-hmm. The idea that comes to mind is, like, where do cases come from? Like, what was the first wine to be put in a case? And why does a case have 12 bottles? Why doesn't it have 10 bottles? You know, that's the kind of odd stuff, but fascinating stuff that that Wine Speed is always tracking down. And I always know that we're successful when I overhear someone say something like, did you know, I just read this interesting thing. Did you know that da-da-da-da-da is true? So, yeah,
it's a great educational resource. And I highly recommend to my listeners that are maybe distributor managers to use this maybe as like an incentive. So, you know, you hit a sales goal, you get a subscription for a year to Wine Speed. I think that's a great idea.
Thank you. We also do corporate subscriptions, by the way.
And oh, good.
Lots of sales companies and wine companies who have multiple employees get it's quite a deal, and they get a corporate subscription for all of their staff. So just wanted to throw
great.
That in.
No, that's great to know. And I'm sure that's going to be very helpful information for a lot of our listeners, because we do have a lot of distributor sales reps and teams that listen to the show. Well, I just want to thank you for your time. You've been so generous with your time. I know how busy you are. You've got a whole operation going there. and I really hope that one day I get to meet you in person and drink a glass of champagne with you. I would love that.
Absolutely, Kristen. Me too. Thank you so much for this wonderful, wonderful conversation. I've really enjoyed it.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Megan Rinks.
And I'm Melissa D. Montz.
And like every other person with access to a microphone, we started a podcast.
On Mondays, we release Don't Blame Me, which is an advice podcast where listeners call in and we share our thoughts on situations such as what to do if you're going to your boyfriend's family function and you haven't told him that you previously slept with both his twin brothers.
Then on Thursdays, we release our podcast, But Am I Wrong?, where we ethically gossip about pop culture, politics, our lives, and your lives. Listeners write in and we tell them if they're wrong or right in a situation. Are you the hero or the villain?
On Tuesdays and Fridays, we throw in a little something extra as well.
Well, something, something. We strive to create a community grounded in activism, mental health, and inclusivity. Think of us as like your blunt, honest friends who give you advice that you need to hear, not what you want to hear. But we're also always rooting for your success. What we lack in credentials, we make up for in
opinions.
We do that in every episode too.
We're professional unprofessionals, so if you're looking for a new slate of podcasts to add to your routine, we're here for you.
Acast recommends.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.